Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Humor by Terry Eagleton. Narrated by Roger Clark. Preface. A good many studies of humor begin with the shamefaced acknowledgement that to analyze a joke is to kill it dead. This is not, in fact, true. It is true that if you want to raise a laugh, it is unwise to joke and dissect your joke at the same time, rather as some U.S. presidents are said to have been unable to walk and chew gum simultaneously. But there are not many comedians who come up with a theoretical inquiry into their wisecracks at the very moment they are delivering them. Those who do so are generally to be found in job centers, not in clubs and theaters. There are, to be sure, exceptions, such as the brilliantly original comedian Stuart Lee, who deconstructs his own comedy as he goes along and analyzes the audience's response to it. Otherwise, humor and the analysis of humor are perfectly capable of coexisting. Knowing how a joke works does not necessarily sabotage it, any more than knowing how a poem works ruins it. In this, as in other matters, theory and practice occupy different spheres. An anatomical acquaintance with the large intestine is no obstacle to enjoying a meal. Gynecologists can lead fulfilling sex lives, while obstetricians can coo over babies. Astronomers confronted every day with the utterly insignificant status of the Earth within the universe do not hit the bottle or leap off a cliff. Or at least not for that reason. There are, to be sure, a number of remarkably humorless accounts of humor on the library shelves. Some such studies come thickly furnished with graphs, charts, diagrams, statistics, and reports of laboratory experiments. One glum trio of scientific researchers even appear to cast doubt on whether jokes actually exist. There are, however, some illuminating commentaries as well, a range of which I have drawn upon in this book. Theories of humor can be as useful as theories of polygamy or paranoia, as long as they are marked by a certain intellectual modesty. Like any fruitful hypothesis, they need to acknowledge their own limits. There will always be anomalous cases, unresolved puzzles, awkward consequences, inconvenient implications, and the like. Theories can be riddled with discrepancies and still perform some productive work. Rather, as a fuzzy photograph of someone can be better than no photograph at all, and a job worth doing is usually worth doing badly. The incomparable William Hazlitt quotes a fellow author, Isaac Barrow, as observing that humor is so versatile and multiform, a phenomenon of which any exhaustive definition is impossible to come by. Sometimes it is lodged in a sly question, in a smart answer, in a quirkish reason, in a shrewd intimation, in cunningly diverting or cleverly restoring an objection. Sometimes it is couched in a bold scheme of speech, in a tart irony, in a lusty hyperbole, in a startling metaphor, in a plausible reconciliation of contradictions, or in acute nonsense. A mimical look or gesture passeth for it, sometimes an affected simplicity, sometimes a presumptuous bluntness giveth it being, sometimes it riseth only from a lucky hitting upon what is strange, sometimes from a crafty resting obvious matter to the purpose. Often it consisteth in one knows not what, and springeth up one can hardly tell how. It is, in short, a manner of speaking out of the simple and plain way, which by a pretty surprising uncouthness in conceit or expression doth affect and amuse the fancy, shewing in it some wonder and breathing some delight thereto. It would be a foolhardy theorist who would seek to cram all that into a single formula. Even so, humor is not simply an enigma, any more than poetry is. It is possible to say something relatively cogent and coherent about why we laugh, though whether I have done so here is up to the individual to judge. T.E. 2017. 1. On Laughter. They laughed when I told them I wanted to be a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now. Bob Monkhouse. Laughter is a universal phenomenon, which is not to say a uniform one. In an essay entitled The Difficulty of Defining Comedy, Samuel Johnson remarks that though human beings have been wise in many different ways, they have always laughed in the same way. But this is surely doubtful. Laughter is a language with a host of different idioms. Cackling, chortling, grunting, chuckling, shrieking, bellowing, screaming, sniggering, gasping, shouting, braying, yelping, snickering, roaring, tittering, hooting, guffawing, snorting, giggling, howling, screeching, and so on. It can come in blasts, peals, gales, gusts, ripples, or torrents, blaring, trumpeting, trickling, swirling, or piercing. There are also different ways of smiling, from beaming, smirking, and sneering, to grinning, leering, and simpering. Smiling is visual, and laughter primarily aural, but when T.S. Eliot writes in The Wasteland of a chuckle spread from ear to ear, he fuses the two phenomena. Chortling, sniggering, and so on denote different physical modes of laughter, involving as they do such matters as volume, tone, pitch, pace, force, rhythm, timbre, and duration. But laughter can also convey a range of emotional attitudes: joyous, sarcastic, sly, raucous, genial, wicked, derisive, dismissive, nervous, relieved, cynical, knowing, smug, lascivious, incredulous, embarrassed, hysterical, sympathetic, skittish, shocked, aggressive, or sardonic, not to speak of purely social laughter, which need not express the least amusement. In fact, most of the forms of laughter I've just listed have little or nothing to do with humor. Laughter may be a sign of high spirits rather than amusement, though you are more likely to think things funny if you are feeling euphoric in the first place. Physical modes and emotional attitudes can be combined in a variety of ways, so that you can titter nervously or derisively, bray genially or aggressively, giggle with surprise or delight, cackle appreciatively or sardonically, and so on. The paradox, then, is that though laughter itself is purely a question of the signifier, mere sound without sense, it is socially coded through and through. It is a spontaneous physical occurrence, most of the time anyway, but one which is socially specific, and as such cusped between nature and culture. Like dance, laughter is a language of the body. Descartes called it an inarticulate and explosive cry. Though the body is also enmeshed in meaning of a more conceptual kind. Even so, it will never be entirely at home in that more rarefied sphere. There is always a surplus of brute materiality over sense, and it is this that a lot of humor allows us to savor. It also encourages us to accept this incongruity as natural. Farce, in particular, tends to dramatize this fateful collision between body and mind. As a pure enunciation that expresses nothing but itself, laughter lacks intrinsic sense, rather like an animal's cry. But despite this, it is richly freighted with cultural meaning. As such, it has a kinship with music. Not only has laughter no inherent meaning, but at its most riotous and convulsive, it involves the disintegration of sense, as the body tears one's speech to fragments, and the id pitches the ego into temporary disarray. As with grief, severe pain, extreme fear, or blind rage, truly uproarious laughter involves a loss of physical self-control, as the body gets momentarily out of hand and we regress to the uncoordinated state of the infant. It is quite literally a bodily disorder. This is one reason why an excess of laughter has frequently been censured as politically dangerous. There is something alarmingly animal about the activity, not least about the kind of noise, hooting, braying, cackling, neighing, bellowing it involves. It calls to mind our affinity with the other animals, an irony, to be sure, since they do not laugh themselves, or at least not conspicuously so. In this sense, it is at once animal and distinctively human. A miming of the noise of the beasts, yet quite unbestial itself. It is also, of course, one of the most commonplace and pervasive of human pleasures. In The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, Milan Kundera quotes the French feminist Annie Leclerc on the subject. Bursts of repeated, rushing, unleashed laughter, magnificent laughter, sumptuous and mad, laughter of sensual pleasure of laughter. To laugh is to live profoundly. Laughter signifies, then, but it also involves the breakdown of signification into pure sound, spasm, rhythm, and breath. It is hard to form impeccably well-shaped sentences when you are thrashing helplessly around on the floor. The disruption of coherent meaning to be found in so many jokes is reflected in the disintegrative nature of laughter itself. This temporary derangement of meaning is most obvious in the absurd or nonsensical, in goonery and surrealism of one form or another, but it is arguably an aspect of all effective comedy. In one sense, laughter represents the momentary collapse or disruption of the symbolic realm, of the sphere of orderly and articulate meaning, while in another sense it never ceases to rely on it. We do, after all, generally laugh at some object, event, utterance, or situation, unless we are simply being tickled, fighting a fit of depression, or registering our pleasure in someone's company. And this involves the deployment of concepts, which is one reason why some commentators have claimed that non-linguistic animals do not laugh. Laughter is a form of utterance, which springs straight from the body's libidinal depths. But there is a cognitive dimension to it as well. Like fury or envy, it involves beliefs and assumptions. In fact, some forms of humor are primarily intellectual affairs. Wit, for example. Farce may convert human action into mere physical motion, but even this depends on moving in a world of meaning. Infants smile almost from birth, but laughter begins only around the third or fourth month, perhaps because of its need to engage the mind. It is true that laughter can gather an uncontrollable momentum of its own, so that after a while we no longer know exactly what we are laughing at, or laugh simply at the fact that we are laughing. It is what Milan Kundera, quoting Annie Leclerc once more, calls laughter so laughable, it made us laugh. There is also the case of contagious laughter, in which we laugh because someone else does, without needing to know what he or she finds so funny. As with certain diseases, you can pick up a dose of laughter without being sure where it came from. Generally speaking, however, laughter alters the mind's relation to the body without suspending it completely. It is worth noting the curious fact that much of this applies to weeping, too. James Joyce speaks in Finnegan's Wake of laugh tears, while his compatriot Samuel Beckett writes in Molloy of a woman whose dog has just died that, "I thought she was going to cry, it was the thing to do, but on the contrary, she laughed. It was, perhaps, her way of crying. Or perhaps I was mistaken and she really was crying, with the noise of laughter. Tears and laughter, they are so much Gaelic to me." In fact, laughing and weeping are not always easy to distinguish. Charles Darwin points out in his study of the emotions that laughter can easily be mistaken for grief, and both states may involve copious floods of tears. In The Naked Ape, the anthropologist Desmond Morris argues that laughter actually evolved from crying. Laughter, in short, is not always a laughing matter. There have been even lethal epidemics of the stuff in China, Africa, Siberia, and elsewhere. Hysterical paroxysms in which, so it is alleged, thousands of people have died. In 1962, one such outbreak in what was then Tanganyika immobilized whole school districts for months on end. Since being out of control is never entirely gratifying, laughter can easily border on the unpleasant. Samuel Johnson defines it in his dictionary as convulsive merriment, which is not always an agreeable experience. The same is true of being tickled, with its curious blend of the pleasurable and the unbearable. As with watching a horror movie, we are gratified, agitated, excited, and uneasy all at the same time. Monkeys who bare their teeth in what appears to be a smile may actually be issuing a threat. Thomas Hobbes writes of laughter in Leviathan as a grimace. We speak of people screaming with laughter, gasping for breath, occasionally having a coronary. Lying through his teeth, the narrator of Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy tells us that he once laughed so hard he broke a blood vessel and lost 4 pints of blood in 2 hours. The novelist, Anthony Trollope, suffered a stroke while laughing at a comic novel, a misfortune by which few of his own readers are likely to be afflicted. Despite its potentially calamitous effects, laughter may be indicative of human progress. Only an animal which has learnt to carry objects in its hands rather than its mouth can leave the latter free for chuckling or tittering. It would be possible to develop a semiotics of laughing or smiling, showing how each genre of laughter or style of facial expression has its place within a complex signifying system. You can, in short, treat laughter as a text, or as a language, with so many regional accents. Upper-class Englishmen, for example, are more likely to bray than middle-class Englishwomen, who are rather more given to tinkling. There is a style of laughter in Belize that one is unlikely to hear in Belgravia. Military generals tend not to giggle, or popes to cackle. Those who play Santa Claus may beam, but they would be ill-advised to snigger. It is hard to imagine Arnold Schwarzenegger simpering, though easy enough to imagine him leering. The president of the World Bank is permitted to laugh heartily, but not hysterically. The ability to assess such modes and tones belongs to what Aristotle calls phronesis, meaning our practical social know-how, as is knowing when humor is appropriate or misplaced. For example, one should not recount the joke, "What's black and white and lies on its back in the gutter?" A dead nun, to an elderly nun at prayer in a cathedral, as one of my children did at the age of 5. Here is another example of misplaced humor. Doctor. "Okay, I've got some good news and some bad news for you." Patient. "Give me the bad news first." Doctor. "The bad news is that you've only got 3 months to live." Patient. "And the good news?" Doctor. "The good news is that I'm just off to Monaco with this unbelievably beautiful woman." We smile here at the discrepancy between how the brutally jesting or monstrously tactless doctor ought to behave and how he actually does, a tension that is spiced by a spot of agreeable sadism on our part at the expense of the hapless patient. We are gratified by the doctor's sheer chutzpah, his barefaced disregard for both human compassion and professional decorum, which allows us vicariously to indulge in our own illicit hankering to be free of such irksome responsibilities. We are relieved, for a few moments, of the inconvenient burden of compassion. Black humor of this kind eases the guilt we may feel at our glee over the discomfiture of others by socializing it, casting it in the form of a joke to be shared with one's friends, and thus rendering it more acceptable. There is some pleasure to be reaped, too, from laughing in the face of death, and thus being able to make light of our own mortality. To jest at death is to cut it down to size and diminish its fearful power over us, as in another doctor joke. Patient: How long have I got to live? Doctor: 10. Patient: 10 what? Years? Months? Weeks? Doctor: No. 10, 9, 8, 7. To confront its own extinction in fictional form means that the ego can achieve a momentary transcendence of it, gaining a brief taste of immortality. One thinks of the symbolic victory over death of Woody Allen's grandfather, who, as his grandson touchingly reports, sold him a watch on his deathbed. Laughter compensates a little for our mortality, as well as for our general infirmity. Indeed, Friedrich Nietzsche remarks that the human animal is the only one to laugh because it suffers so atrociously, and needs to dream up this desperate palliative for its afflictions. Gallows or graveyard humor, however, involves more than a disavowal of death. To cut death down to size with a casual jest is also to vent our spleen on it for the disquiet it causes us. There is also the question of our unconscious desire for what we fear, what Freud calls thanatos, or the death drive, pulverizes meaning and value, and is thus bound up with that fleeting derangement of sense we know as humor. Like humor, this Dionysian force garbles sense, confounds hierarchies, merges identities, scrambles distinctions, and revels in the collapse of meaning. Which is why carnival, which accomplishes all this too, is never very far from the cemetery. In cutting the ground from beneath all social distinctions, carnival affirms the absolute equality of all things. But in doing so, it sails perilously close to the excremental vision, reducing everything to the sameness of shit. If human bodies are interchangeable in an orgy, so are they in the gas chambers. Dead leveling, as one might call it. Dionysus is the god of drunken revelry and sexual ecstasy, but also a harbinger of death and destruction. The jouissance he promises can prove lethal. The doctor joke, then, grants us some momentary relief from the need to behave with decorum and treat others considerately. It also allows us to stop agonizing for a few brief moments over the prospect of death. The notion of humor as a form of relief forms the basis of one widely influential view of it, the so-called release theory. The 17th century philosopher, the Earl of Shaftesbury, sees comedy as releasing our constrained but naturally free spirits, while Immanuel Kant speaks of laughter in his Critique of Judgment as an affect resulting from the sudden transformation of a heightened expectation into nothing, which combines the release theory with the concept of incongruity. True to this approach, the Victorian philosopher Herbert Spencer claims that mirth is caused by a gush of agreeable feeling, which follows the cessation of unpleasant mental strain. In Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious, Sigmund Freud argues that jokes represent a release of the psychic energy we normally invest in maintaining certain socially essential inhibitions. In relaxing such super-egoic repression, we save on the unconscious exertion it demands and expend it instead in the form of joking and laughing. It is, so to speak, an economics of humor. On this view, the joke is an impudent smack at the super-ego. We exult in these Oedipal skirmishes, but conscience and rationality are also faculties we respect, so that a tension is set up between being responsible and running riot. Hegel speaks of the ludicrous in his Philosophy of Fine Art as the upshot of a collision between an ungovernable sensual impulse and one's higher sense of duty. It is a conflict reflected in boisterous roars of laughter, which, as we have noted already, can be as alarming as they are agreeable. Perhaps most jokes betray a murmur of uneasy laughter at the prospect of bringing the father low. Fearful of being punished for this insolence, our delight at seeing the patriarch dethroned is edged with nervous giggles of guilt, which then spur us to chuckle even more as a defiance against this disquiet. If our laughter is edgy, it is because we fear the consequences of this illicit enjoyment as much as we revel in it. This is why we cringe as well as chuckle. The guilt, however, mixes a certain spice into the enjoyment. In any case, we know that the conquest we have chalked up is purely provisional, and a paper victory, too, since a joke, after all, is simply a piece of language. We can therefore indulge in our iconoclasm while assuaging our guilt about it, secure in the faith that the father, a figure whom, after all, we love as well as hate, will not be permanently disabled by this minor insurgency. His abject loss of authority is purely temporary. It is just the same with the fantasy revolution of Carnival, when the morning after the merriment the sun will rise on 1,000 empty wine bottles, gnawed chicken legs, and lost virginities, and everyday life will resume, not without a certain ambiguous sense of relief. Or think of stage comedy, where the audience is never in any doubt that the order so delightfully disrupted will be restored, perhaps even reinforced by this fleeting attempt to flout it, and thus can blend its anarchic pleasures with a degree of conservative self-satisfaction. As in Ben Jonson's The Alchemist, Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, or Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat, we can wreak some gloriously irresponsible havoc, while the parental figure is absent, but would be devastated to learn that he or she might never return. In the more innocuous kind of joke, so Freud argues, the humour springs from the release of the repressed impulse, while in obscene or abusive joking it stems from the relaxation of the repression itself. Blasphemous jokes also allow us to relax such inhibitions, as in the tale of the Pope and Bill Clinton dying on the same day. By some bureaucratic blunder, Clinton was dispatched to heaven while the Pope was sent to hell. The error, however, was rapidly rectified, and the two men managed to snatch a quick word as they passed one another travelling in opposite directions, the Pope remarking on how eager he was to see the Virgin Mary, and Clinton informing him that he was just 10 minutes too late. In Freud's view, the pleasurable form of the joke itself, wordplay, snatches of nonsense, absurd associations, and so on, may lead the superego to relax its vigilance for a moment, which then allows the anarchic id an opportunity to thrust the censored feeling to the fore. The forepleasure of the joke's verbal form, as Freud calls it, lowers our inhibitions, softens us up, and in doing so cajoles us into accepting the joke's sexual or aggressive content, as we might not otherwise be ready to do. Laughing is, in this sense, a failure of repression, yet we are amused because we acknowledge the force of the inhibition in the very act of violating it, so that, as Sandor Ferenczi points out, a totally virtuous individual would laugh no more than a totally villainous one. The former would not harbour discreditable feelings in the first place, while the latter would not recognise the force of the prohibition, and would therefore feel no particular thrill in transgressing it. As Freud points out, we may be less moral than we like to think, but we are also more moral than we imagine. Like the neurotic symptom, jokes for the release theory are compromise formations, incorporating both the act of repression and the instinct being curbed. So it is that the joke for Freud is a double-dealing rogue which serves two masters at once. It must bow to the authority of the super-ego.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?